We welcome to the program our friend, author Colin Fleming. Lots of great books available from Colin. Highly recommend his most recent collection, If You Brackets, Fabula, Fantasy, Effery, Hope, or for the holiday season. Listen, you couldn't do much better any time of year than picking up his book, Scrooge. Colin joins us this afternoon, as always. Hello there, Mr. Fleming.
Good evening, Kimball.
By the way, what a wonderful piece you had in the New York Daily News celebrating the 100th anniversary of Charles Schulz's birth.
Yeah, New York Daily News a few days ago. And I'm sure we've talked about Peanuts many times over the years. So ended up writing about 30 things this year, only one of which came out, but it was that. And so it's out there if anyone wants to read it.
Well, today we're going to do a deep dive on a favorite of yours and a classic of the holiday season, 1964, the Rankin-Bass production of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer that, thanks to you, I got to watch again yesterday, and then I'll watch it live tonight because, as you pointed out on the blog, there's something extra special about watching it as it airs live.
You have to watch it live. You really do. It's a different experience, and not only do you have to watch it live, you need to be dialed in. You need to be a specialist. It airs multiple times. The kids are so spoiled these days, Kimball. It airs multiple times each year, and you want to see it that first time. Even though we're in a gray area where it's in November and it doesn't feel maybe as Christmassy as it ought to, just a couple days make a lot of difference in the calendar. But I texted my sister like once a year. I text her. It wasn't the only thing I text her about. But I texted her today, and not to deprive her children, and to have them watch Rudolph tonight, because I just love Rudolph so much. I've always loved it so much. I've ever since I entered this world, and it's a special that it means a lot to me. I could watch it over and over again.
What did it mean to you when you first saw it? What made you identify with this?
It represented wonder to me, and I didn't realize it at the time. I just intuited. I felt a kinship with it, but the freedom of the characters and their openness to, especially Rudolph and Hermie, their openness to magic. And it sounds maybe bromidic or something like that, but as a child, I identified with that. It's the same way I identify with that now, or I channel that now when I'm writing something. It really comes from the same place. And we think of it as something primarily for children. But the stuff that's the best for children is really for adults. Mm. It might even be more for adults than it is for children. I mean, I hope my nephew and nieces watch this tonight and everything, but for an adult to watch it with an open mind, and I think people think, oh, I can't be seen liking this thing. It's for children. What does that say about me? And people get hung up on weird inhibitions like that. And I would say that if you get hung up on inhibitions like that with something like Rudolph, you're someone who would get hung up on inhibitions with the Wagner opera or whatever it is. I think nature, a walk in nature. Anyone can go out in nature and be in nature, but it's not the same as walking in nature. And I think it was, Rudolph was one of those things. Peanuts was another one of those things. The woods was another one of those things that made me think in terms of that magic. And when I was a kid, obviously you believe in Santa and everything. And you watch something like Miracle on 34th Street, and the whole premise is Santa real? And my nephew might be coming to the end of his run. This might be his final year in believing in Santa. And I think Santa's a more overreaching concept than fat dude in a red suit. And I would even say that I believe in that, what that spirit represents more now than I did as a wide-eyed kid of 5 or 6, just loving the special so much.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. I think my son is getting to that point, you know, at 8, almost 9, that this might be the last go-round, where he believes in what I call that version of Santa, the one that you embraced as a little kid. But when people say to me, you know, when did you stop believing in Santa? My reply, and it's not just a canned one, is never. Because I believe in a different type of Santa now, which to me is that adult version that makes the season so special. And I think it's those beliefs that are celebrated in Rudolph and Charlie Brown Christmas and others.
The adult version is the version. It's the definitive version. And the adult version is present in the kid version. The adult version is a more expansive Santa, but it's not a diminution of imagination. And I would say that I had a hiatus where I didn't realize how persistent my belief had been. And I was sort of answering that question that you mentioned in terms of the chronology of that thing you found out on the bus being confirmed by your parents when you brought it to them. Like you put there, okay, this is a Santa on trial, very Miracle on 34th Street, and your parents leveled with you. And not to knock my parents, I don't know how I would have taken it at the time, but I feel like if I was a parent, or if I'm ever a parent, I would say, okay, hold on, time out. There's this extra bit. There's the Santa addendum. And I should at least reference that to you, young Nilok. Going backward. I have it all picked out. It'll be like, oh, okay, that's cool. I was a misfit with that name you gave me, but I'm glad that this comes around again later in life. But it's not something that you can necessarily impart to someone. A lot of times, knowledge isn't just the truth. It's a co-action. It's a partnership of truth and timing. And so this came around full circle again for me, certainly. And I write cool things about hockey and everything, and I look like a big, tough guy. So it's easy for me. I feel maybe easier for me to express some of these loves that I have that maybe, I mean, if my dad had said to me, I just love the hell out of Rudolph, I would have thought, kind of strange, man. But I don't know. I feel like it's how I should be. It's who I am.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. Well, I was six when it first aired, and I remember watching it. But it took me a few years to realize how different it was from the kind of Christmas specials that aired before that. And it still stands out today.
And how different it was from itself. I was actually going to ask you that. If you remembered when you watched it the first time, it was quite a bit. It was a different cut. Well, it wasn't just a different cut. Parts hadn't been made yet. And I've never seen it in the original version in which it aired, where there's no trip with Santa at the end to the Island of Misfit Toys. Those toys are kind of left hanging. That was all added in 1965. So that wasn't there in early December 64 when the special first aired. But the specials prior to Rudolph were almost Christmas variety programs. And some of them could be good. Like, it wasn't a bad thing to have Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra going from a studio apartment to some winter wonderland, and they're duetting together and all of that. But it had a roving Ed Sullivan quality, a lot of singing, and not really so much storylines. Where we got the storylines was with our old friend, radio Christmas episodes. What's interesting about Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, one thing that's interesting, is we've spoken about how radio essentially comes to an end in the early 60s. Suspense is going off the air. Johnny Dollar is going off the air. And that's going to be it for the most part. But it wasn't it for any part in Canada. Canada was still really into radio. And so everyone in this special, excepting Burl Ives, was Canadian, because they were harvesting the talent from Canadian radio shows. So we have the country to the north, I guess it's fitting, closer, more North Pole adjacent, to thank for the special itself.
And how interesting, too, and maybe because of that Canadian influence, that they brought in Burl Ives to play Sam, who at that point in his career was known as being a flaming radical, a singer, and I think probably most recently people would have remembered him raving about mendacity. Mendacity is a Big Daddy and Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. He didn't seem like the ideal narrator for a kid's show, but now you can't imagine anyone playing Sam other than Burl Ives.
And in part because Sam was designed, his look mirrors Burl Ives' look, and it's the perfect marriage of real-life person and animagic character. The special starts, and we get that newsreel sort of footage, which is very Citizen Kane.
Oh, yes.
So we know that we're dealing, like, that was the medium that Wells had worked in part, before he came to do Citizen Kane on radio. So we get, like, the newsreel, news on the march type of thing. You get those half dozen ominous notes, and we're caught up to speed on the eventual snowstorm. And then we go to Sam, and Sam is to this special as Beatrice was to Dante with the Inferno. He's going to be our guide, our friend, our wise confidant, who has sagacious counsel for us. There's this wonderful moment, this beat, and Burl Ives was a great singer, and I think that's important here. As with narrators, like, the best narrators are also great singers or good singers. They have singing experience. Out of the Past with Robert Mitchum. Mitchum sang, and you can close your eyes and watch that film as a record, or hear that film in a way. So we get Burl Ives, and he has this beat where he goes, "Ah, youth." And it's just so simple, but it's so complex at the same time. And he's commenting on what he's just seen. If you're an adult and you're thinking the exact same thing that he's just said, and maybe you're thinking, where is your youth? It's not gone. Maybe it's come back to you, or it's never left, or it's asserted itself with greater fervor than when you were some mopey child. I think that's the thing about Christmas. It's an opportunity, a reminder, rather, of possibility and age and all of that. You get rid of all that stuff. So right from the first, it sets that tone, and we have Sam Snowman, and we like this guy. He's convivial. We want to hear what he has to tell us. And frankly, that is such a crucial component of any great story. It's not just going to be the story. Whoever's telling us the story, whether it's first person or third person, that voice matters. And voice is something that we discussed in connection with writing. But the voice of this piece, as it were, is Burl Ives, the Sam Snowman. It doesn't work without him.
And obviously, too, in a show that's geared for kids, but also is certainly respecting the adults who are watching, the outsiders, the nonconformists, play such a big role in this. And yes, obviously, that's the story of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer in the original story and the song. But Hermie and so many others are on the outside looking in, and yet they are the heroes of this tale.
Oh, definitely. And I saw this in a theater at the Brattle in Cambridge on the big screen a bunch of years ago, 4 or 5 years ago now. And people were reacting to the aspects that weren't politically correct. But you know what's not politically correct, quite simply, is life. That's not how life works. And I was talking to someone the other day about bullying. And you'd think that with how everyone is surveilled now, that bullying would be pushed out of culture, because it's so easy for the teachers to know what's going on. Things are happening online. But the same way that you hear about these fights at, like, youth events, sporting events, and the dads get into, like, a brawl, and it's like an 11-year-old Pop Warner thing. And you'd think that wouldn't happen anymore, because you're going to be on camera, and that's going to affect your employment and your life and all that stuff. But you just can't excise that human component from people, no matter how much everything else in the world changes. And Rudolph himself is bullied fairly brutally. I mean, it's horrible the way it goes down. And then Hermie is, Hermie is all excited. Big night for him. He was in his cups extra early today, and I said, "That's fine, sir. You enjoyed that symbol of whatever."
Yes, it's your night, Hermie.
Yeah, you knock yourself out, clean up the stick afterwards when you're done. But I think something that interests me too in Rudolph is that Hermie is clearly a gay character. And that was something that it's not on the nose, but it is on the nose. We think of all of these breadcrumbs within the show, whether it's puns like Fireball. They're not talking about a Deep Purple album. That's like really on the nose, and the teeth pulling and the three guys in the bed with the dainty flowers outside. And where Hermie stands underneath the bumble is very suggestive of a certain act and his mannerisms and everything, his voice, his hair. But none of that matters. Straight, gay, Rudolph with the red nose, no one cares. No one should care. And I think that's a great lesson. The only thing people should care about is how you are and what you do for other people. And the people in this story, the characters who are stand-ins for people, they do the right thing by each other. And it's also important to note that in doing the right thing by each other, they influence the community in which they live and belong, and the community that had previously ostracized them. I think that's important. There's a lot. Like, you're an adult. You're sitting there, and you can easily watch this and think, maybe I'm like the guy. I'm not Rudolph. I'm the guy just cracking down on Rudolph relentlessly. And yeah, this is uncomfortable. Maybe it doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah, am I the dad that makes my son wear a fake nose over his glowing red nose? Man, what a horrible thing.
You know who else is horrible? And he could be in a lot of these Rankin Bass specials. Santa! Santa's a dick!
Oh, big time. He and the boss of the elves, not guys you want to work with or for.
Oh, Santa's worse than the boss of the elves. The boss of the elves, he's just like that. He's just dumb. Santa's mean. He's cruel. And then he exploits Rudolph later. He's like, okay, yeah, you can make this work for me. He's all buddy-buddy with them. But Rudolph has to be thinking to himself, this isn't someone you trust. He's moody. Poor Mrs. Claus.
Oh, yes.
And she's like, okay, it's time for you to get obese. And that happens like in 2 minutes. And he's just, I don't know. He would seem to be a tough guy. That's what I feel like. You're an angel, Mrs. Claus. Because he is a bear to live with. He's all over the place. He comes in for elf choir practice. One person's not there whose heart wasn't even in it, and Hermie, and he's just bitching. I mean, but right from Rudolph's birth. I mean, it's right after he's born. He comes in and says to him, you suck. Hope you can fix this, Rudolph's dad. I'm out. Although before he's out, he does an incredibly catchy song that I remember dancing to when I was a little kid in the breezeway of our house in Mansfield, Massachusetts. My dad comes out. My dad was a stoic man. He was not like a singing and dancing man. And I wasn't a singing and dancing kid, really. But he sees me, and he's like, you're enjoying that? I'm like, yeah, it's pretty good. I liked it a lot.
I like the fact, too, that the women in this understand some of the shortcomings of the men around them, whether it's Mrs. Claus or later on when Donner tells his wife and Clarice that, you know, he's got to go out and do the searching, because it's man's work. And then, of course, as soon as he's gone, off they go.
Yeah, when that line was uttered at the Brattle, all of the hipsters and the woke people and all, they just hooted and howled. And it's like, people try so hard sometimes to find something to object to that they're missing really just how people talked at the time, what context was. It wasn't really, like, if you watch a Western, people use the word womenfolk, but they can be open to everyone. It just was a word at the time. Mm. People aren't masters, certainly, of the lexicon. So they're going to use what everyone else around them uses. It doesn't mean they're pro this or anti that or anything, but it is also a special of fierce feminine agency, that the women are the people who keep things together. And you know what? Rudolph and Hermie both have a strong female aspect. You should. The more, quote unquote, manly you are, the more pronounced of a female aspect you have. Mm. It's called having multiple parts and being comfortable with who you are and not trying to hide that. Like a quote unquote real man wouldn't feel a need to hide who he is or who he feels or how he feels and how he expresses himself. And sometimes when we talk about things like feelings, those are more typically predominantly feminine qualities. But Orson Welles said correctly, the best artists are more feminine than masculine. And it's not even like how we think of male, female, or how we did. It's nothing like that. It transcends those limitations. But the best qualities of the people in this special tend to be female in nature.
Is it just me, or do you also get kind of a Wizard of Oz vibe when they get to the island of misfit toys? Jack in the Box, the Sentry, to me, is a lot like the gatekeeper at Oz. King Moonracer, very much like the wizard.
Oh, sure. Yeah, you think about those flying monkeys in The Wizard of Oz. And The Wizard of Oz is one of those films. And you know what? So, too, is Rudolph as a TV special. Depending when you come in, same with Wizard of Oz, same with It's a Wonderful Life, it's frightening. I was at the theater the other night for Casablanca, and as I was walking in, there was a trailer for an upcoming screening of It's a Wonderful Life. And so I just overheard it as I entered. I thought, it's like a horror film. This is frightening. So when they go to the Island of Misfit Toys, and you get that Wizard of Oz vibe, and then you have them in this austere palace, like nothing in this palace except this flying lion creature, King Moonracer. And I love that sequence too, where he's like, you're not even welcome here. You can't stay.
you got one night and then you have to go.
Yeah. And Yukon Cornelius turns to them, Hermie and Rudolph. He says, even among misfits, you're misfits. I mean, that hits hard. There are just so many, if you can't identify with that at some point in your life, I don't know how many risks you've ever taken to put yourself out there. And I would say that you haven't lived as much as you were put here to live. And then he claps his hoofs together, footmen, and then they go off to the cottage. It's a very Cape Cod type of cottage. It's in this frozen place with the flowers outside and everything. And there's a fraternal intimacy to the conversation they have. They're in these tight quarters. They're in the same bed. And Rudolph, like, I'm leaving. I don't want to jeopardize you two. He's thinking in terms of others. And they say, no, you're our friend, and we're going to stick together. It really is legitimately quite moving, that part. And then Rudolph departs anyway. He sort of sacrifices himself. I mean, they knew what they were doing with this first one, certainly.
And I know, and I'm sure I wasn't the only kid, horrified when you thought Yukon Cornelius was dead.
Yeah, that messed me up, too. And it's not just that he dies. It's that he died in this stupid, senseless, sort of show-offy fashion. So that's maybe something you think about as a kid. And it's maybe something you should think about more as an adult, as you're always gunning for the attention, right? He was kind of gunning for some attention. But it's not just the ostensible death. It's how quickly it's acknowledged, but then everyone moves on.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
And you think like, wow, it just all keeps going if I'm here or I'm not. And that's a lot to put on someone's plate as they're viewing, but it's delivered in such a way that it's not terrifying. It's not something that makes you cry. It's not something that gives you nightmares, but it does make you feel something, and it makes you think, and it sets up, of course, his big triumphant return with an explanation. And even the Bumble is a misfit who wants, in Crime and Punishment, there's this character that Raskolnikov kind of feels bad for named Marmeladov. And Marmeladov is this drunk, and he's given up on life, and he's going to be run down in the street and horrible death and all of that. But before that death happens, he says to Raskolnikov words to the effect that everyone needs a somewhere where they belong. And the other side of that is he doesn't have it. And it's something that stays with Raskolnikov. It's also something that we can trace to even Rudolph, this 1964 special that everyone, even the Bumble, is pulling a marmalade off and needs that space where they belong. It's something that every human being, no matter how self-reliant they might be or appear, needs.
And how fulfilling that was as a kid, and maybe more so now, that in a world of kids' stories that are often just black or white, that even the bad guy turns out to have some redeeming qualities and maybe was just misunderstood.
Yeah, I think that's the exception to the rule. Usually people, if you don't think they're terrible, you just don't know them well enough. Spend some more time with them, get to know them, and see what's going on. So I look at it as another opportunity to keep an open mind. I would think that Rudolph thinks to himself, okay, this Bumble, he's here for tonight. This is good. Unicorn Cornelius has him contributing to the community, but I'm still going to be watchful of this guy. I'll cast the weather eye on him, lest I turn my deary back. And he's trying to sink those. I've noticed his teeth are back. Sink those teeth back in. And it's wise. It's just a wise special. It's so tuneful. It's not the crazy, druggy monstrosity. I'd written about it once. I think it was for the Daily Beast, but I was watching last night Rudolph and Frosty's Christmas in July, which is just a mega acid trip of a Rudolph special. It's insane. Just when you think like nothing else can happen, it's so perverse. They're like, get Jack Frost, and he comes in for a cameo. They got pretty out of control, but this is the best. It's like the first Star Wars. If it was standalone, it's not just entertainment. It works as a kind of art.
How long do you think this show will keep airing on a regular basis? We're closing in on 60 years now, and obviously that's, I'm sure, more legs than Rankin and Bass probably thought it would have back in the 60s, but can it keep going for another 10 or 20 years? Will people still turn to it as us first-generation viewers die out?
Oh, yes. I would expect it to always be around. I would expect it to be around in 200 years. I think it's like Hans Christian Andersen's fairy tales. It's just a totem that taps into the essentials of human DNA. And it's something that makes money, and there's that. And you're right, they didn't expect it to last, certainly. And the original puppets, most of them were just burned, because the same way that episodes of whatever on the BBC were taped over at the time, Doctor Who, we wish we had them now. But it's one of those touchstones. It's a totemic touchstone. I would expect that it will always be around. I mean, what's always around? Is Hamlet around? Hamlet's around. I'm not saying that this is Hamlet, but there is a cultural market for something like Hamlet. And I'm someone, too, it's what I work towards. I think that the world can get better than what it is right now. And I think people who haven't heard or watched Rudolph, I think if they heard something like this discussion, I bet they would think, I'd never heard it talked about that way. And they'd go out and check it out, and they'd share it with the people they know. So I think once that boomer generation is gone, it's really not going to matter. I just think it'll always be here.
Obviously, you know the special inside and out, but what do you find each year? Are there new things that you discover, if not about Rudolph and the story, then about the world?
Oh, yeah, definitely. There is, for instance, after Rudolph has been shamed, this is just really what's happened, and everyone has laughed at him at flight practice. Clarice, who just met him, has a loyalty towards him. And it's not just a loyalty towards him, it's loyalty towards someone because it's the right thing to do. And one thing that you want to do when you're writing a story or something like that, you want to have the relationships seem like they've always been in place, and now the reader or the viewer has only come to them, but they've joined them in medias res. You want to start friendships fast. I mean, the first Star Wars is successful, because those friendships are instantaneous, but they don't seem forced. And she follows him for the walk home, and he tries to shun her because he's smarting, he's hurt. And she won't allow that to happen, but she won't allow it to happen with this prevailing gentleness. And that's something that I've noted in years as I've changed, as I've tried to find ways to help people maybe that I hadn't thought of before as I grow. So that's the sign of a true work of art. You go along and it kind of goes along with you, and it imparts different things to you at different portions of your life. And this definitely fits that bill.
Watch it tonight. Watch it live and see if you don't see some things maybe you didn't pick up on before after this discussion with Colin this afternoon. Thank you, Colin. Appreciate it.
All right. Sounds good.
We'll see you next week. Colin Fleming, every Tuesday on Downtown.